Good evening. The acting attorney general denies he's helped President Trump fight the Russia investigation. The administration misses a deadline on Saudi Arabia, and a Superfund site in Brooklyn stirs community outrage. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, February 8th, 2019. The first trucks carrying U.S. aid to Venezuela arrived yesterday from Colombia. They are being blocked by the Venezuelan security forces of President Nicolas Maduro. Maduro says a humanitarian crisis does not exist in Venezuela. The aid was requested by the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, who has declared himself the interim president. A top Saudi official, meanwhile, maintains that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman did not order the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The New York Times reported Thursday that a year before Khashoggi was killed, the prince told an aide he would use a bullet on the journalist if he did not return home and end his criticism of the government. Meanwhile, the Trump administration did not meet the deadline to report to Congress on whether it will impose sanctions on anyone responsible for the murder of Khashoggi. In October, congressional leaders triggered the Magnitsky Act, which gave the administration 120 days until February 8th to report back on who was responsible for the death of Khashoggi and whether it would impose sanctions on that person or persons. The UN human rights investigator leading the international inquiry into the murder of Khashoggi says evidence shows he was a victim of a brutal and premeditated killing planned and perpetrated by officials of the state of Saudi Arabia. The United Nations Special Rapporteur said on Thursday her three-member team had access to part of a chilling and gruesome audio material of the murder obtained by Turkish intelligence agencies. A final report will be delivered to the UN Human Rights Council in June. And the House Judiciary Committee was the scene of a contentious and sometimes uproarious hearing where the star of the show was Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker. The hearing was a chance for newly empowered Democrats in the majority to grill a committed loyalist to President Donald Trump. GOP members ridiculed the meeting as a pointless dog-and-pony show. Whitaker, while exasperated with Democrats, sought to ease their concerns by denying he ever discussed Robert Mueller's investigation into potential coordination between Russia and the Trump campaign.
In your capacity as acting attorney general, have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel?
Mr. Chairman, I, as the acting attorney general, I am under the special counsel's rules. I am the person that is ultimately in charge of the investigation, and I have exercised that authority under the special counsel's regulations of the Department of Justice.
So I assume the answer is yes.
Regular order, Mr.
I assume the answer is yes. You have been asked to approve a request or action, and you've said yes or no. In other words,
Mr. Chairman, I want to be very clear about what you're asking me. Are you asking me if I have asked the special counsel to do something?
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
Is this whole thing? Well, I'm asking if I think my words were clear enough. Have you ever been asked to approve any request or action to be taken by the special counsel? Last week, you commented on the status of the investigation, stating it was close to being completed, unquote. This was said despite the fact you recognized just moments before that it was ongoing, stating, quote, I really am not going to talk about an open and ongoing investigation otherwise, close quote. So all I'm asking you is, have you been asked to approve or disapprove a request or action to be taken by the special counsel?
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
I've asked the question.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Point of order is not in order until the question is answered.
We're not operating under the five-minute rule anymore, then?
Point of order, the witness will answer the question.
I want to be very specific about this, Mr. Chairman, because I think it's going to allay a lot of fears that have existed among this committee, among the legislative branch largely, and maybe among some American people. We have followed the special counsel's regulations to a T. There has been no event, no decision that has required me to take any action, and I have not interfered in any way with the special counsel's investigation.
Very good. Thank you. My time has expired.
Whitaker's frustration was evident as he repeatedly insisted he would not discuss conversations with the president and deflected questions he didn't want to answer. At one point, Whitaker called time on a long-winded question from committee chair Gerald Nadler, drawing gasps and laughs.
Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up, and so I'm here voluntarily. We have agreed to 5 minute rounds, and
the committee.
I think that's a fine place to end the 5 minute rule.
The committee will end. Will come to order. I will point out that we didn't enforce the 5 minute rule on acting Attorney General Whitaker. We will.
I understand, Mr. Chairman. I was just saying that might be a good breaking point at that point for you.
No. The Attorney General was in the middle of saying something. Answer the question, please.
Whitaker repeatedly dodged questions that touched on specifics of the Mueller investigation. He declined to say if he still agreed with critical statements he made about the Mueller investigation and refused to break with Trump's characterization of the investigation as a witch hunt. Whitaker's testimony had been in limbo after the Democratic-led committee approved a subpoena to force him to answer questions. Whitaker said he wouldn't appear unless the subpoena was dropped. A compromise was worked out and Whitaker appeared voluntarily. But the Attorney General said he would not reveal details of his conversations with Trump, opening the way for a likely fight with Democrats. Whitaker had been chief of staff to former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who was forced to resign last November. Whitaker was an outspoken critic of the investigation before arriving at the Justice Department in 2017. And the National Enquirer's alleged attempt to blackmail Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos with intimate photos could get the tabloid's parent company and top editors in deep legal trouble and reopen them to prosecution for paying hush money to a Playboy model who claimed she had an affair with Donald Trump. Federal prosecutors are looking at whether the Enquirer's feud with Bezos violated a cooperation and non-prosecution agreement that recently spared the gossip sheet from charges in the hush money case, two people said who were familiar with the case. The clash between the world's richest man and America's most aggressive supermarket tabloid spilled into public view late Thursday when Bezos accused it of threatening to print photos of Bezos and the woman with whom he was having an extramarital affair. He said the Enquirer made two demands: stop investigating how the publication recently obtained private messages that Bezos and his girlfriend had exchanged, and publicly declare that the Enquirer's coverage of Bezos was not politically motivated. Enquirer owner American Media Incorporated said Friday that its board of directors ordered a prompt and thorough investigation and will take whatever appropriate action is necessary. Earlier in the day, the company said it acted lawfully while reporting the story, engaged in good faith negotiations with Bezos. In recent months, the Trump-friendly tabloid acknowledged secretly assisting Trump's White House campaign by paying $150,000 to Playboy centerfold Karen McDougal for the rights to her story about an alleged affair with Trump. The company then buried the story until after the 2016 election. And Governor Andrew Cuomo warns that what he calls political pandering to critics of Amazon's proposed secondary headquarters could sink New York's biggest ever economic development deal. But opponents say they'll keep fighting a project they see as corporate welfare. Friday's back and forth with the governor came after the Washington Post reported that Amazon is reconsidering its planned New York City headquarters because of opposition from local politicians.
Thank you, Governor Kevin Gershowitz. You've championed the Amazon deal as one of the greatest economic opportunities for our state. And yet, with the recent opposition that's real, and much of it in your own party, how do you counteract that, and do you actually believe this opposition has a chance at preventing the plan from going forward?
Yeah, as I just mentioned, there's an article today in the Washington Post that says Amazon is thinking of pulling out. This was a national competition where they had hundreds of applications. People were courting them, governors, senators, mayors, everybody wanted them to come. We win. We win. It was an amazing victory that we won. We celebrated. Well, there's opposition. There's always opposition. They're moving into Long Island City, part of Queens, which is now basically all factories. The Long Island City waterline was called Queens West. My father started it back in the 90s. Queens West was supposed to be mixed-use residential and commercial. The commercial never happened. Amazon would transform that whole area. The local surrounding community is nervous. Why? Well, if you bring in Amazon, what's going to happen to rental housing? Is it going to be hard for me to afford it? Valid, bona fide concerns, but also natural to any development. There's a second part of the opposition that is ideologically based. What, Amazon is rich, Jeff Bezos is rich, we shouldn't offer them any incentives. When they say incentives, it makes it sound like we pay them to come. We don't pay them to come. They pay us $27 in revenue. They get $2.5 billion as of right benefits from New York City. As of right, any company that moves in gets those benefits. We gave them a $500 million capital construction program. It's like saying they pay 10% taxes per year. Instead of 10, they'll pay 9%, okay? That's the economic package, much less than other places offered. But there's an ideological group that says corporate welfare, Bezos is rich, we shouldn't give him anything. And then there's a pocket that is worried geographically, what's going to happen to my neighborhood? It is not my party. It is not my party. The popularity of Amazon is about 80% across the state, Democrats and Republicans. In New York City, in Queens, it's about 70% popular. It is a very small nucleus, and it's a very small group of politicians who are pandering to the local politics. The problem is the state Senate has adopted that position. And that's what could stop Amazon. And if they do, I would not want to be a Democratic senator coming back to my district to explain why Amazon left because I pandered to their politics. It would be a tremendous loss. It is the largest economic development transaction in the history of the state of New York. And I understand politics very well, but I've never seen a more absurd situation where political pandering and obvious pandering so defeats a bona fide economic development project.
Opposition has been swift and fierce since Amazon announced in November that it would bring its HQ2 and reportedly 25,000 jobs and $27 billion in tax revenue to Long Island City. Governor Andrew Cuomo and Mayor Bill de Blasio have both touted the deal as an economic development win for New York City, but much of the criticism is focused on the subsidies that Amazon will get, as much as $3 billion through a combination of tax incentive programs from the city and state. Critics of the deal include City Council member Jimmy Van Bramer and State Senator Michael Gianaris, who represent Long Island City, and Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
And respect public housing. And then we go, before you rezone, fix our homes. Before you rezone, fix our homes. Before you rezone,
on Wednesday night, residents from four NYCHA housing developments in Brooklyn flooded a community meeting on a rezoning project for the neighborhood that surrounds the Gowanus Canal. The site of New York City's largest superfund, the Gowanus Canal, is a former industrial waterway that's been in constant use for 400 years and is currently one of the most toxic places in the city. The cleanup has been planned for years, mostly against the wishes of New York City officials since Michael Bloomberg was mayor. The author of Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, a narrative history of the canal from 1636 to 2011, is Joseph Alexiou. He says the canal has gone from a wetland to an open sewer and now sits next to some of the city's most valuable land.
So the Gowanus Canal is found in Brooklyn, in between the neighborhoods of Carroll Gardens and Park Slope. And it is now the former industrial thoroughfare. So it was an industrial canal that was dug in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s to become a number of different things. But it was the exit of a sewer. It was a transit lane for all kinds of goods. And it was also a drain for the flooding that used to happen in Brooklyn before the city became a city. And actually, you know, I talk about 1636 because the canal used to be just called the Gowanus Creek, and it's a naturally occurring body of water called a tidal estuary, which basically means it's just kind of an arm of the sea that goes upland. And it used to be surrounded by about a square mile of salt marshes, so it really was like a wetland. So the canal, as it is today, is kind of like a drained wetland, and it is extremely polluted with both toxic waste, and it is full of raw sewage as well, which is two of the main reasons why it's so controversial.
So there was a very large turnout at a community meeting with the Department of City Planning 2 days ago of the Gowanus community. What does the city want to do, and why is there so much uproar?
What the city ultimately wants to do is change the zoning in Gowanus to allow for, you know, what they say mixed use, but mostly they want to create a whole bunch of new residential properties. Up along the sides of the canal, they would like to have anywhere from 14 to 22-story buildings. And then in this, again, traditionally low-scale neighborhood, even up to 30 stories in some other places. And the community, I think, is in an uproar for a couple of reasons. I would say the immediate uproar of the other night, you know, with the community meeting, what was frustrating to the community that I understood was that the way that they showed this, you know, announcement of the zoning, they thought that it was going to be a presentation with a speaker and someone kind of there to demonstrate what was happening and to answer questions. But instead, there was no presentation. It wasn't even clear at all what people were supposed to do, just walking around looking at posters without any reps from the city offering up any real answers to questions in front of a group. The people feel like this isn't really addressing their concerns. So that's about 50% of why, you know, people are upset. And the other 50% of why is that, the community has done a lot of these kinds of meetings where they go and they give their opinions and they answer questions, ask questions about how the zoning should change. And a lot of people felt like all their views weren't represented in the final plan. In fact, it seems like a lot of things were left out. And the upzoning, 22 stories, 30 stories, nobody ever, in my memory, but nobody in the community ever remembers selecting that as an option they would be comfortable with and saying that that was their preference. Mm-hmm. So they're seeing a lot of stuff in this presentation that they didn't ask for, and they did not, and then a lot of things they were promised that didn't make it in. And then at the end of it, at this presentation, there was no one there to even explain or defend any of these choices.
Since 2002, the canal has also been a Superfund. Since 2002, the canal has also been a Superfund site. Actual work began in 2017. Alexiou says hundreds of years of industrial activity have left the canal's toxic sludge and unknown chemicals and sewage a toxic cocktail that can never really be totally cleaned.
Right now, the EPA has, for the last 10 years, been designing and getting ready to implement a really serious cleanup plan, which addresses two of the main issues of the canal, one of which is at the bottom of it, approximately 10 feet thick across the almost two-mile-long canal, and about 100 feet wide. There's a 10-foot thick layer of what the EPA calls black mayonnaise, and that's a combination of toxic waste, mostly coal tar, and raw sewage, which comes out of the sewer system into the canal every day and at a huge amount, like some 400 million gallons a year. And so this twofold problem is something the EPA is addressing, and they have to do it by stopping the raw sewage, which also contains some toxic waste, from going into the canal, and then they have to dredge all of the toxic stuff off the bottom of the canal and cap it in such a way so that the canal bed is protected again. And also because under the canal bed, in the ground under the water, there are plumes of more of this toxic waste that go very deep down. And so the cap also stops that toxic waste from migrating upwards and bubbling up out of the ground. They will never be able to, no budget of the city, no federal budget, nothing will ever be able to remove the sheer amount of toxic waste that is there. When the EPA, they took a tiny little strip of the bottom of the canal as a test project, and they did it over the summer. And I think they had like some huge number of trucks, 30 trucks or something like that, to truck out just that small, tiny little bit of waste. There's so much toxic waste under the ground, not just under the canal, but in the immediate block, 2-3 block radius of the canal, that I think the city's afraid to talk about it or even address it in a way that really speaks to the reality of how polluted it is.
What's the threat of this? Is there a problem? Can't you just put a cap over, just ignore it? Nobody goes swimming there. What's the problem?
Well, you know, that is basically the plan. The plan is to cap it and not worry about it. As far as swimming in it goes, people swimming in it would be fine if they remove the toxic waste, as long as there's no more raw sewage flowing into it. So when I say raw sewage, I mean that there are direct connections between toilets and sinks in that neighborhood and emptying into the canal.
Oh, I see.
So if you want to swim in that, you're more than welcome to, but there are legal water quality rules and laws that say that that is not legal. The way that it works is that the original sewer system of Brooklyn is known as a combined sewer system, and that means that the water from the ground when there's rain flows into the same pipe ultimately as the sewage water. So in a new system, those two bits of water would be kept completely separate. But because they all flow into the same big pipe, that pipe is supposed to go to sewage treatment plants. But there's just not enough room in those pipes for the amount of rainwater that comes down in New York. So if you don't have an emergency exit, so to speak, then it will come out of the sewers, the sewer caps into the street, or even go back up into houses. Mm-hmm. So instead, that backup flows into the canal. Yeah. And that has never been fixed.
Are they planning to fix it now?
It is within the plan of the EPA to fix this with these sewer tanks. I'm sorry, with two retention tanks, which have been prescribed as part of the cleanup effort. However, the city of New York, is responsible for paying for, building, and maintaining these tanks. And I can say from my own personal sort of following of the cleanup efforts over the last 10 years, the city has done everything they can to slow this down and to stop those tanks from getting built at all.
Why?
Ultimately, it comes down to money. And if not money, they want to retain some control over what happens in the land around the canal. And there's reasons for that. One, mainly, the land around the canal has been deemed extremely valuable. And so because of that, they want to make sure that, well, I can't prove this, but it seems like they're trying to get the land into the hands of as many developers as possible. They also would slow down this cleanup if they could, because they don't agree with the EPA engineer who's been given control of this project on a whole variety of matters. And they're combative because it's not clear why, but it seems to be politically motivated and mostly centered around real estate money that is so hotly interested in the area. Jared Kushner owned a piece of property on the canal until very recently, and I wouldn't be too surprised if he wasn't still connected to it in some way.
Joseph Alexiou is the author of Gowanus, Brooklyn's Curious Canal, a narrative history of the canal from 1636 to 2011. And in more community news, the city evacuated buildings beside an embattled former schoolhouse after discovering cracks in the building, according to fire and building department officials. Inspectors and engineers with the Department of Buildings investigated cracks at 350 East 10th Street's facade after a 311 call Wednesday morning. The building is known as Charas El Bohio. It prompted fire officials to evacuate four nearby apartment buildings on East 10th Street as a safety precaution. The building's owner, Greg Singer, said it was all a bunch of nothing and charged opponents to his plans for that building with creating a fuss. Singer claims, quote, "It's all political. That is part of a concerted effort to put pressure on us." He added that there's definitely cracks, but we were already aware of, and that will be pointed and repaired, but there's no immediate danger. After surveying the building, city inspectors determined the building is safe, but did issue a violation to Singer for failure to maintain the exterior facade. The former school has been at the center of a debate roiling the Lower East Side community since 1998, when a mysterious auction handed the city-owned property to Singer. Protests and legal action prevented him from developing the property, and his conflict with the neighborhood took on a personal cast. Charas El Bohio had been an important center for the community since the school moved out and the East Village was shunned by moneyed interests. As the locale turned around after numerous riots blamed on police, contested elections, federal probes, values rose, and developers were attracted back into the neighborhood. Louis Caridad is the assistant director of GOALS, Good Old Lower East Side, a group that advocates for tenants in the mostly rent-stabilized units in the area. He says Charis could again become a center for the community of the city if the city follows through on its promise to buy back the building.
Charis Arroyo is it's a space, a community space that is on 10th Street between avenues B and C, the Lower East Side, the East Village, if you will. And it's the site of former PS64. After the school was closed, different community members made use of that space, and various arts and social justice organizations worked out of there and did a lot of great, very important work in this community. This was at a time when, you know, the community was suffering from abandonment, when, you know, it wasn't necessarily a desirable neighborhood the way it is now, and it really served a very important purpose as a community center in many, many ways, and as a place where artists and activists could gather and do important work.
How did you lose control of it? How did it come to be in the hands of the owner today?
That was in 1998 when it was. So it was sold to a private developer who wanted to turn the space for profit, right? He had several ideas about how to make it into a profitable site, but neighborhood residents, activists, local elected officials had wanted that building to return to public, to community use. We feel it's a very important resource.
Does GOALS see this? Does the community see this as a winnable? How would you get it back from the Mr. Singer?
Well, the mayor promised at a town hall in our community recently that it was a mistake. First of all, he stated that it was a mistake for the city to sell this building, and that the city was interested in reacquiring it. And we were very happy to hear that, because we do feel like this is a building that should be returned to community use.
And the city concluded the Singer's proposal violated what is commonly referred to as the city's dorm rule and served the site with a stop work order that remains in place. Singer is in the midst of suing the city to develop the land. And that's some of the news for Friday, February 8th, 2019. The news is produced with Jessica Brockington. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.